Hej och välkommen till Blödigt värre med mig, Johanna Paus Darlington. Trots att de flesta barn med blödarsjuka idag kan leva ett ganska normalt liv tack vare den profylaktiska behandlingen, så finns det ju ändå vissa begränsningar och aktiviteter som inte rekommenderas eller som bara inte känns helt hundra när oron pockar på. Som förälder själv så vet jag hur svårt det är att dra gränsen för vad mina friska barn ska få göra eller inte, och jag kan bara tänka mig hur svårt det måste vara som förälder till ett blödarsjukt barn. Även om fotboll är okej enligt rekommendationerna, vad händer vid en rejäl tackling? Och vad händer om barnet visar sig vara en jättetalang på en sport och inte vill något annat än att satsa? Kommer kroppen verkligen hålla för det? Hur man ska tänka måste ju vara upp till varje familj och barn. Men kanske kan ni som lyssnar där ute åtminstone få lite inspiration och vägledning efter att ha hört på dagens avsnitt. Jag har nämligen ringt upp en riktig världsstjärna, proffscyklisten Alex Dowsett. Han är idag den enda kända idrottsmannen med hemofili som tävlat på den allra högsta nivån i samma tävlingar som helt friska personer i 118 km i timmen. Han har alldeles nyligen lagt cykelkarriären på hyllan efter att ha tagit mängder av medaljer i stort sett alla stora cykelmästerskap. Nu ägnar han sig bland annat åt att få fler barn med blödarsjuka att våga satsa på sport. Hi Alex, how are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Tell me what you're up to these days.
Oh, just moved countries and moved house, moved countries as well. So it's been quite hectic. But yeah, recently retired from professional cycling. I would still call myself a cyclist, but not at the same level anymore. And starting life after professional sport, which has been good fun so far. I've enjoyed it.
And that's why you moved countries as well, because you stopped the professional cycling.
Yeah, we lived in Andorra, and we lived at the top of a whacking great big mountain at 2,000 meters altitude to be training at altitude, and the minute cycling finished, I learned how to ski. Like I sort of did a winter of skiing, which was good fun, and then moved back to the UK, which is where I'm from, so back to near my family and friends, and yeah, it's a new chapter.
You've had a fantastic career as a cyclist. How did it all start?
It is very hemophilia focused. It's like a lot of kids, there was a lot of sports I wasn't allowed to do in school. Football, rugby, the two main ones, and they're two of the main sports in school. And sort of I had this mentality that I wanted to be in sport and I wanted to be good at sport. My father really helped, because he would say to me, yeah, unless you try a sport, you're not going to know if you're good at it. And I think deep down, I wanted to be good at sport. And a lot of that comes from the hemophilia, sat on the sidelines, somewhat watching. I was a swimmer. I did some athletics. I sailed dinghies, did some go-karting, because my dad was a race car driver. And then started mountain biking with my father. And one of the guys there had a road bike, and I asked him if I could have a go on the road bike, because it's not super accessible, and went and did a race, and I enjoyed it. It wasn't like a light bulb, like, oh, he's the light bulb moment where I realized this was my sport came a year later, but I enjoyed it. I kept going back, kept getting faster. I think my dad was told once or twice that I had a talent for it, but we didn't really know what that looked like. And then, yeah, I was racing against men a lot and doing well, but I was never raced much of against kids my own age. And I went to the sort of national championships for under 17s, and I was 14 years old. So I was two years younger than the oldest guys, and finished second overall.
Wow.
The top 10 was, the top 10 was all 16-year-olds. And then there was one 14-year-old sat in second place. And that was kind of the light bulb moment where I was like, oh, right, I'm actually good at this. Mm. I liked it before, and then I started to love it. Because I think, and that was always where it came from. I just loved being good at something. But yeah, I think sort of circling back, I definitely had a head start in cycling because I was swimming so much. And I was swimming because the doctors the haemophilia doctors had said swimming was so good for haemophilia. I wasn't very good at swimming. It was good for me, but I wasn't very good at it.
So it wasn't as fun, maybe?
No. I like the social side of it. I'm competitive and we'd race and I would never win. I wouldn't even be close to winning. But so the swimming gave me that fitness. So when I did get on a bike, I didn't really have to get fit. And I think I wouldn't have been trying all of these other sports if I could do the sports in school. So I'm very grateful to my haemophilia for providing that sort of impetus, that catalyst, I guess, for cycling. And I'm very confident if it wasn't for my haemophilia, I probably wouldn't be a professional cyclist. Certainly wouldn't be on this podcast.
For how long have you been doing this now? You started when you were about 14.
I'm 34, so it's 20 years ago.
Wow.
21 years. Yeah, 21 years I rode my first race. And it's good. I've raced some of the biggest stuff, like Tour de France and World Championships. Just the Olympics. Just the Olympics was the one I didn't quite get to, which is going to haunt me for the rest of my life. But I did some good stuff otherwise.
Yeah. You were diagnosed with haemophilia when you were 3 years old, right?
18 months.
18 months, yeah. Okay. Does anyone else in your family have the disease, or are you the first?
No, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, my mum is a carrier, and my grandfather from my mum's side sadly died before I was diagnosed. They're pretty confident he wasn't a haemophiliac. He got pretty beat up in the war, and he made it out with some kind of quite big injuries. So I'd imagine if he had haemophilia, probably wouldn't have got that far. So yeah, they're pretty sure it starts with my mum. And then I have a 2-year-old daughter, and she's a carrier. So it continues.
It continues, yeah. How did your diagnosis affect your everyday life in your childhood?
Well, I think from the point of view of the haemophiliac, it's not great, but it becomes normal pretty quick. Yeah, you don't know any different. So I'm always of the opinion it affects the family more than it affects the actual haemophiliac in the younger ages, because I mean, yes, the injections they're not great. Like, there's nothing fun about them. It wasn't until I got older that I realized I had something up with me, and there was a bunch of kids that didn't have something up with them, something wrong with them. Not wrong, I don't even like the word wrong, but different maybe. So I always thought it's much tougher on my mum and dad and sister than it was me, because they had to learn about a condition they'd barely heard of. They'd heard of it, but they'd only heard sort of terrible things with, because you're just recently out of the blood contamination scandal. So there's a lot of, when you hear haemophilia, you hear a lot of HIV and hepatitis talk as well, which is pretty scary. And then it's a lot of hospital trips, a lot of wondering what the future's going to hold. And it's tough, really tough. But we trod our own path. I think there was the thing we decided not to do, we went to one or two, and my mum and dad recall it, they'd go to other parents to learn about like life with haemophilia, and it was just everyone wanted to share their most negative, everyone wanted to share horror stories, like negative stories. It was all so much negativity. And my mum and dad, bless them, they're brave. They took a step back and went, you know what, we're gonna work this one out for ourselves. We're gonna tread our own path. We definitely took some risks that we perhaps wouldn't have done if we'd gone to all of these doom and gloom sessions. We never went into these sports. We never disrespected the condition, because we figured like the doctors should be the ones telling us yes or no. And they never really, if we'd gone in and said we want to go do boxing, they'd have gone, absolutely not. But like, we went in and we said, hey, we want to do dinghy sailing. And they said, yeah, like, that's good. Just head injuries are big. So maybe a helmet. And so I was me and my sister, because my parents didn't want me to be the odd one out, would be the only ones in the sailing club wearing helmets. So we never disrespected the condition.
And how did that affect you, you think?
Well, I think it was quite inspiring. It was like my parents were great for not trying to just say no. It's like if I come home and say, I want to play rugby, instead of saying just like, no, you can't, it would be like, no, you can't, but we'll take you swimming. or no, you can't, but we'll go to the local go-kart track, or no, you can't, but we'll join the local dinghy sailing club and try this. And then obviously cycling. Like I started, I think that by that point, when I was 11 and started mountain biking with my dad, like I was a kid that rode my bike, like all kids do, fell off once or twice, but always had a helmet on. And then when cycling was starting to get a bit more serious and road based, we said to the doctors, look, this cycling thing seems to be a possible avenue. What do you think? And the doctor sat there and just said, we'd prefer it if you played chess or a musical instrument. But if that's what you want to do, we'll support you. We're not going to stop you. And this is the thing, when it came down to the cycling, and it was a question I had in a talk in Portugal. It really threw me. A doctor in Portugal who, there was an audience question to the crowd, and she said, I think it's deeply irresponsible what you've done. And I was like, whoa, okay. She said, yeah, it's a dangerous sport. And I was thrown. Luckily, I had it was myself and my own consultant who were there just by coincidence. Like he was the consultant that the charity or the company putting on the conference wanted, and then they wanted me as well. And he interjected, he said, if I can answer, sure, Alex falls off. Right? And we've repaired a few broken bones, and you know, there's been a few cuts and scrapes and bruises. Let's talk about the Alex that doesn't race a bicycle. I weigh 75 kilos, which equates to 2,000 units of factor VIII every second day. And he said, if Alex wasn't a cyclist, because I think the lady also brought up cost, like cost to healthcare systems from when I break bones.
Okay, that was the irresponsible part, or?
That and the message, just the whole thing.
Yeah.
So the cost and the message it sends out, what if a load of kids like start road cycling? He said, let's talk about the Alex that doesn't race a bike. He's 85 kilos, not 75, because he's not exercising as a job. Like literally my office is to go out and ride 5 or 6 hours and be as light as I can be. And actually to be as healthy as I can be is my job, or was up until October last year. He said, so the Alex that doesn't cycle is probably 85 kilos, like probably fighting a bit of weight like most of us are, and needs 3,000 units of factor VIII every second day. So that's an additional cost. He says, I wouldn't mind betting that the four bones we've had to break, the cost of that doesn't scratch the surface on the cost of Alex being unfit and 10 kilos heavier and all of the actual bleeding episodes that could happen as a result of that. He said, so I actually think what Alex has done is quite responsible. You know, it's testament to the how important being healthy, fit and healthy, and having strong muscles, strong joints is. From an exercise point of view, cycling is great because it's low impact. It is low impact until you hit the floor because you've fallen off. And it's quite high. It's quite high impact. But it's.
But how often did that happen? That you've fallen off? Is it every week or once a month
a
year?
By the end of my career, I got very good at not crashing. I did a 2.5 year stint with no crashes, which then started to scare me because I was like, you know, sort of superstitious. I was like, I'm due a crash now. It's been too long. One crash a year would be the average.
Okay.
One or two. In the most part, you take skin. You just sort of it's a bit of skin off on your side, elbows. I broke collarbone, shoulder blade, elbow, thumb, and a couple of ribs. And I didn't know I broke the ribs until months later on when they scanned me for something else. They asked when I broke my ribs, and
I did.
I did well in that respect, and I think again where hemophilia has changed, when I was a kid, the doctors would say if I was to break a bone, I'd be in hospital for a month to control the bleeding. That used to really scare me, and because I knew collarbones, cyclists and collarbones was the one. And in 2010, I was racing in Holland, and halfway through the race, we take a bag with food in, like with energy food and energy drink. And I took the bag a bit wrong, and it fell into my front wheel and popped me over the handlebars. And I went to get up, put my hand on the floor to sort of lift myself up on the floor, and I had a lot of pain going through my shoulder blade. I was like, whoa, it's a little more serious this than just a bit of skin. So laid back down, hospital, broken shoulder blade. They said I'd broken it well because I didn't need any surgery. I was terrified because I was like, not because of spending a month in hospital or my health, because I had European under 23 European championships in 8 weeks after that collarbone break. Seven or 8 weeks. And I was like, but the London hospital sent me home pretty quick. They were just like, bit more medication than normal. Instead of every second day, take it every day for 2 weeks and then you can go back to every second day. I was like, okay. I was like, what can I do? They're like, we'll rest it. After 7 days after the crash, I got on my bike indoors. And then 12 days after the crash, I started riding outdoors, not under the recommendation of any doctors. I just had European championships looming. I'm terrible for if someone says I can't do something, I'm going to go out there and show them I can. It's quite irresponsible in some respects, but it's helped in others. And when I was going in for a checkup on my shoulder blade, a nurse that she's a pediatric nurse, so she usually works with children. And I knew this because she spoke to me like I was a child. I said, what can I do? And she's like, oh, nothing. You need to rest it. I said, okay, but I've got European championships in like 6 weeks now. And she said, oh, yeah, you won't be doing that. I said, well, I need to, and I need to train for it. And she said, no, you won't be doing that. I was like, right, well, I'll show you. Yeah, went to European championships, won it. It's on paper, it's not the biggest result of my career. But I think for me, it possibly is because of the circumstances around it. Oh, it's funny because on the podium, all I could think about was that month in hospital that I should have had, or that like the previous, 10, 15 years ago, I would have had. And the nurse telling me that I wouldn't even be competing.
But was it a big struggle for you? Like, were you in pain the whole time? Or
as long as I had my medication, bleeding was under control. And I think the general rule of thumb with sort of modern day physios, if it doesn't hurt, you're good. Like, don't do anything that hurts. As a cyclist, the shoulder blade's good because it doesn't affect you if you put all your weight on your hands out in front of you. So you could not press up, but you could do a plank with a broken shoulder blade, but you couldn't do it with a broken collarbone. So actually holding myself on the handlebars of the bike was pain-free. So I was like, well, if it's pain-free, then it's not doing me any damage. So I'm going to do it. I mean, my doctor, when I did go in 2 weeks after the crash, my doctor, Dan, was like, are you riding? I was like, yeah. He's like, are you riding on the road outside? And I was like, yeah. He's like, okay. He's like, I'm not going to tell you not to, but you do know if you crash again, you're going to be in real trouble. I was like, yeah.
That was the big risk. That was a big risk. Not really you, it was, not healing, but
yeah. Mm. Yeah, crashing again. And it was on the back of my mind. I rode very carefully. Yeah. Probably not my most responsible moment, but
But you won, right?
Yeah. So unfortunately I'd do it again.
How did you prepare for a race with regards to your treatments? Did you at all?
Well, I think the most frustrating part of it all was having to take the treatment with me. I mean, the races are all international. So, the long ones, we call them the Grand Tours, which is like the Tour de France. There's also one in Italy and there's one in Spain as well. I'd have to take 3 weeks worth of treatment with me, like in my hand luggage. So, yeah, I had to do it, but it was normal, but it was a bit frustrating. Mm. So, yeah, if my treatment would be every second day, I would make sure that on race day was a treatment day. So I might miss a day. Like my treatment plan was very much catered around risk. So if I'd be training Monday, Tuesday, but having a rest day Wednesday, I'd take my medication Monday. That'd cover me for Monday, Tuesday. And then if I was racing Thursday, I wouldn't have any on Wednesday, because there's no risk. So pretty much we sat on the sofa all day on a rest day. And then I'd have it Thursday morning because the race would be like higher risk as well.
And talking about treatments, how was your treatment during childhood? Was it also every second day or how did it?
Well, you probably can split it into two parts. First part was up to the age of 10 or 11 where it was reactive. So I'd have an internal bleed. I wouldn't have any treatment. And then when I had a bleeding episode, I would then have treatment. And then, yeah, at 12, they put me on to prophylaxis treatment, which I think was 1,000 or 1,500 units every second day initially. And then when I got bigger and heavier, it went up to 2,000 units. Yeah.
So you just got your treatment on demand as a child. Did that affect your joints? Do you have any problems with your joints and so today?
Yes, but not much. I've got an elbow and an ankle. In my elbow is just limited range of movement, which doesn't, I barely notice it. If I have to put on a tie, which is quite rare as someone that wears active sportswear every day.
Might be doing it more now.
Might be doing it more now.
You never know.
Right? Yeah, it'd have to be a clip-on job. an ankle, which didn't really give me any trouble during my career, but I'm running, doing a bit of running now, running the London Marathon on Sunday, like this Sunday coming. My ankle has not liked running much. That's been, I've had to manage it and sort of work on it slowly, but it's been pretty good. It's actually improving. I met once with World Hemophilia Association. And he asked that question to me. He's like, have you got any problems with joints? I was like, oh yeah, I've got an elbow that doesn't bend properly and an ankle. And then I made the mistake of asking him if he had any, and it was quite the list. I was like, oh, okay, well, yeah, there's nothing wrong. I'm fine.
But he was a bit older then.
Quite a bit older, yeah. And it certainly gave me a lot of perspective. And I think, yeah, what's nice is talk to the young haemophiliacs now, and it's different because they've never experienced an internal bleed, which in a way presents new problems. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's great. But suddenly they've got this condition, which they have to have either a portacath or injections for. They've never actually experienced the symptoms, I guess, of the condition. It's like blood test has told them they have haemophilia, but it's managed. I think that's tough for a kid, because then I knew exactly why I couldn't play rugby, because I would have a sore ankle or a sore elbow or a sore knee. I would have these bleeding episodes. It'd be like, even if you said go on to that rugby pitch, I'm on crutches. I can't do that. But now you've got these youngsters who have the same condition I do, but they've not experienced the downsides to it. So I'd imagine it's going to be tougher to say to them, you can't be on a rugby pitch or in a boxing ring or whatever they want to do. Like, there is limitations, but yeah, the good outweighs the bad.
You told me that you always had like a lot of luggage with you, like in the hand luggage, all your treatments when you're going to different races and stuff. Do you have any thoughts about upcoming treatments, such as like gene therapy or something that wouldn't require so much stuff?
Yes, I think I haven't had a checkup since I stopped cycling. I'm due one very soon, I think. So it's not a conversation I've had with my consultants. I know whilst I've been racing, we've been of the opinion that if it's not broke, we're not going to fix it. What we've been doing has worked, and we don't really want to change anything. I know there's treatments that are longer lasting than what I've been taking. So I think there's a conversation to be had there. Yeah, and the gene therapy one is interesting. I asked my doctor about it, just how it's going for the trial patients. And he said for haemophilia B, it's great. It's perfect. For haemophilia A, which I have, it's a little more complicated.
Has your haemophilia ever been in the way of your cycling? I know you already talk about the big luggage, hand luggage you need to take everywhere, but
no, it's been nice actually. I had a mum a talk once said, "What does your team do when you crash?" And yeah, it's a when question, it's not an if. And I said, "Well, okay, if I can get up and carry on, like if I've just cut some bruises, then I will. And if I can't, then I need to go to hospital." They said, right, so pretty much the same as everyone else in the team. And I said, hospital's going to panic when I arrive, but otherwise, no different to anyone else on the team. To this mum of a newly diagnosed haemophilia, she was like, right, so you're in quite a dangerous sport. and you are being treated no differently to any of your teammates. And I said, no, I guess not. She says, right, then why should my son be treated any differently at school? And I said, I can see that. And I think that was a super important message that came from my cycling career.
You've set up an organization called Little Bleeders, right?
Yeah.
And it aims to encourage children with bleeding disorders to engage in sports, especially cycling and swimming. Why did you do this?
Yeah, so an opportunity arose when I was sort of 24 with the large pharmaceutical company to travel around Europe with a campaign that we called Miles for Haemophilia to talk about my story. The good thing is the pharmaceutical company, from their point of view, and I know they get a bad rep in a lot of ways, but for me, they wanted to encourage a healthy lifestyle, which if you think about it, the knock-on effect of that is actually less medication sold, because less problems. So in my eyes, that was a good thing. So we traveled around, talked, visited multiple countries, went to Stockholm, talked there. Yeah, Finland, Portugal, Spain, Germany, Austria. Yeah, all over. And I knew in the haemophilia world that I was a little bit unique, but I didn't realize how unique, for one. And then I didn't realize the power of my story to provide a best case scenario when there's so many worst case scenarios. I thought about the family meetings that my parents decided not to go to because it was doom and gloom. And I was like, I'm now providing exactly what they needed in 1990. My manager and I at the time, he was like my manager for cycling teams and stuff, but I was always like, I want to do more. So we said, what can we do? And it was like the obvious one was start up an organization, a charity. In the first few years, we were focused on policy change in government and stuff, which was fine. Like we did some good stuff, but it wasn't really what I wanted us to be doing. And then in the last couple of years, we've really changed direction and created the Sports Fund, which has been very well timed in light of we have a cost of living crisis here in the UK. So a lot of family, and for young haemophiliacs, a lot of the sports that are good for young haemophiliacs are extracurricular. They cost, they're after school clubs and they cost money. And a lot of the families that want to take their kids to these extracurricular, like gymnastics classes, dance classes, swimming, cycling, they can't because it costs money. So we provide we've had some generous donors. I've used my platform to raise a lot of money for Little Bleeders as well. I did a world record attempt, failed a world record attempt 2 years ago, but we didn't fail because we raised, £55,000, which I guess would be about 70,000 euros in for that, which was massive. And the amount of families that can support now is colossal. It's a really good thing. My partner, Chanel and I run it. We've got a bunch of phenomenal trustees and it's great.
And do you encourage any sports that kids want to do, or do you have some restrictions on what you will fund?
That's not a problem we've had to face just yet. No one has applied asking to go to extra rugby lessons. Or it's interesting sometimes how geographical it can be as well. So when I was a kid, my parents asked about skiing holidays. My dad used to ski. Mum, not so much of a fan, but dad used to ski. And the doctors were like, we're not keen. Like, knee injuries are pretty commonplace and stuff. So we're not. And that's where the element of respect came in. If with the doctors, if they advised something and you went against it, you felt like you're disrespecting them. And they worked so hard. So skiing was off the table. And that was fine. Because in the UK, we have to travel to go skiing. But I was in Norway in November talking about skiing. And it was obviously a room full of parents and youngsters with haemophilia. And all like skiing. We basically ski to school. Everyone skis in Norway. You can't tell anyone in Norway not to ski. I was like, okay. So it's funny how it's geographical in that sense. And I skied this winter. And
yeah, did that inspire you to start skiing maybe?
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I opened my eyes. Yeah, I hurt myself. I got too confident too quickly and hurt myself.
Have you ever thought about what life choices you would have made if your parents were more cautious with you as a kid, if they didn't have this approach to hemophilia and that they had?
I don't know, because I never felt like I made any decisions, but I never felt like they did either. I always felt like it was joint. We handled hemophilia as a team all the time. Growing older, sort of, and being a parent myself makes me, I think, a lot more of the way my parents handled my hemophilia and how hard it must have been at times, and everything's worked out pretty good. Mm. So I wouldn't have changed anything.
What has the cycling given you in terms of experience and life lessons, would you say? I mean, you led a fantastic life, you said, a lot of times.
No, it's been great. It's been great. I've done everything that 8-year-old Alex would have wanted. You know, I was one of the best in the world. And on paper, I finished 5th in the world championships. It's like I was in 2019, the 5th best in the world at what I do. I think if you told 8-year-old Alex that was going to happen, he'd have been real proud. I don't think I'd have met my other half without cycling. So I don't think I'd have met my other half without hemophilia. You know, a little girl who I share something with, and that she's a carrier and I have it, and we're gonna have to tell her about that one day. Just real proud of the way it panned out, you know, both, yeah, my parents and proud of myself, because I think it could easily have gone in a different direction. And we came at it with always the mindset is like, we know what we can't do, but let's go and find out what we can do. And I think that was the best thing we could have done. So I wouldn't change a thing. In terms of life experiences, it's been, traveled the world. It's fun with races. You go to places that you just would never go as a tourist. It's been mad, but in terms of life experiences, it's like, it's vast. And now I am retired in the sense that I've finished one career path and starting another. But it's very odd. And a lot of my friends the same age still feel like they're just getting going. And I'm like, well, I'm done. I'm starting again. It's great.
Do you have any plans? What will you do now?
I mean, we've got, little bleeders. We want to just keep building on that. That's, I've talked about that. And we just want to keep doing what we're doing and keep trying to do it better. I'm still going to continue working within cycling. I, as a cyclist, I formed quite a good reputation for being quite good with the technical aspect of going faster. So working with a clothing brand on that, called No Pins, which is good fun. Helping a team of under 19s. Just spending a bit more time at home, not being on a plane as much as I used to be. I mean, my daughter's, she's 2 years and 3 months old, and she's been on well over 60 flights. And that includes COVID times. Like, it's staggering. So we're hoping to, and that doesn't hold a candle to the amount that I've been on. So we're hoping to bring that number down a bit and just enjoy being at home.
You told me your daughter is a carrier. And we know that carriers can also be affected by bleeding symptoms depending on the individual factor levels. What is your advice to her for the future?
Listen to the doctors, respect what they say, and respect the condition, but don't let it control your life. Be open-minded that it could be a great thing that happens rather than a burden. And just, every year that goes forwards, it becomes a better environment for a hemophiliac. We touched upon that earlier. So I don't think it's very easy to say to a youngster, oh, you're so lucky because you're born here, but they don't care. They're not going to care about that until they're in their sort of late 20s or 30s. So there's a lot of opportunity.
What are your hopes for the future when it comes to the hemophilia treatment and so on?
Yeah, we want to strive towards a place where there is no hemophilia. I think ultimately, I mean, I know it served me well, but there's, for every one of me, there's so many that are not having the same, having a much tougher time. Let's not beat around the bush. Without the medication, there's hemophilia is a diabolical place to be, condition to have. So I think that's what I hope for the future, that it doesn't become, that hemophilia doesn't continue to be a kind of disease where your country of residence defines the level of care you get. That's had me in tears at times when I had a dad of a hemophiliac message me, and he was like, what can I do to like help my son have the best opportunities? And he was from Ukraine. This was like way back, so obviously way before everything has started in Ukraine now. And I was like, yeah, just get him swimming a lot, like I did, and just keep on top of your medication. He was like, oh, I have to drive. If my son gets a bleed, I have to drive 4 hours to the hospital to get one dose of medication. I was like, an 8-hour round trip for something that I have a stockpile of in my fridge just because you were born in Ukraine and I was born in the UK. That's not fair. So many don't have the same access to it. And that's what I hope for.
Thank you so much for sharing your great story, showing that you can reach the very top and your dreams despite a hemophilia diagnosis. This was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been, been real good.
Det är imponerande att höra hans historia, vilken karriär han har haft.
Verkligen, det är helt fantastiskt.
Magnus Aspdal, du är fysioterapeut som arbetat med barn med hemofili sedan många år och är bland annat specialiserad på att hitta ledblödningar och tidiga ledförändringar med hjälp av ultraljud. Välkommen till Blödigt Värre.
Tack snälla.
Vad tänker du när du hör Alex historia?
Ja, det är ganska många saker som kommer upp när jag hör den här historien. Dels att han är en otrolig idrottsman med ett jättedriv. Han är lite rebell också, att han har gjort saker kanske som inte var okej från hemofiliteamet på den tiden. Och nu är han ju en otrolig inspiratör. Så att, ja, det är många, många saker som kommer upp när jag lyssnar på det här. Fantastiskt, kul att lyssna.
Han har ju mått väldigt bra, måste man ju säga, både under sin uppväxt och sina år som professionell cyklist. Och det trots att han pressat kroppen på många sätt. Är det här ovanligt för någon som har en hemofilidiagnos, eller är det något som man kan förvänta sig nu för tiden?
Både ja och nej, ska jag väl säga. Han har nog haft ganska tur också, med tanke på att han hade en sån här on-demand-behandling. Att han bara fick behandling i efterhand fram till han var, vad sa han, 10-11 års ålder. Och att han ändå har klarat lederna under den tiden, det är ju fantastiskt. Det kanske tyder lite på att han har en, vad vi kallar en god blödningsfenotyp. Att han kan klara ganska mycket innan det händer någonting i leden. Men de flesta personerna nu med hemofili som har en fungerande behandling, man utvecklar inte antikroppar, de ska ju kunna leva precis som alla andra egentligen. Mm. Förutom det här att de behöver ta medicin regelbundet.
Ja, alltså man ska ju till exempel undvika sporter där man möter en motståndare, det vet jag att ni säger.
Precis.
Ja, kampsporter, boxning till exempel. Mm. Men sen har vi ju ett gäng sporter där det är lite mer luddigt. Jag tänker utförsåkning till exempel. Eller friidrott kanske. Också cykla. Cykla som Alex sa, att det är hårt när man väl ramlar. Liksom.
Precis.
Hur ska man tänka kring val av sport?
Ja, det är ju den stora frågan. När man väljer sport sådär, så tänker jag väl ändå att man ska försöka dela upp det lite grann i hur belastande är själva träningen för lederna framförallt och musklerna också. Och så sen hur stor olycksrisk finns det i den här aktiviteten. Som till exempel vissa sporter som friidrott kan ju vara ganska påfrestande på lederna både på träning och under tävling. Medan cykling är där träningsdelen, om man gör det på en stationär cykel eller när man är ute och cyklar med sina lagkompisar i lugnt tempo, så är det en jättebra sport. Men det finns alltid den där olycksrisken om man skulle ramla Vi försöker egentligen att inte förbjuda sporter, utan det vi försöker göra det är att informera familjen och barnet, eller den vuxna patienten också för den delen, om både fördelar men även tänkbara risker med varje idrott. Vi försöker göra föräldrarna förberedda att man kanske har medicin med sig på träningar och på matcher. Man har lindor med sig. Och så sen att vi från sjukvården ska ju också då se till att möjliggöra det här så gott som möjligt. Att de har en bra behandling och att de är kanske lite extra boostade inför en match till exempel.
Men är det så att ni från vården stöttar i princip vad som helst? Även om ni kanske känner så här, den här sporten kanske inte är jättebra för någon med hemofili eller blöda sjuka av något slag.
Är det en idrott som vi vet är stor risk för allvarliga skador så säger vi att det här rekommenderar inte vi. Men om vi då får en känsla att barnet eller personen kommer att fortsätta göra det så får ju vi då försöka möta upp det helt enkelt. Med kanske lite extra skydd, alltså dels medicinskt skydd, att mer behandling. Men även också skydd i form av vadderade knäskydd eller .
Alex Dowsett visar sig ju inte bara vara duktig på cykla utan superduktig. Så bra att han satsade superstort och gjorde karriär av det. Mm. För honom gick det ju bra, men generellt sett, är det en bra idé att satsa på elitsport som blöda sjuk?
Ja och nej skulle jag väl säga. Ja, att nu med de olika behandlingarna som finns i dagsläget så är ju det vår målsättning att de ska göra precis det de vill. Om det då är att bli byggarbetare eller bli elitidrottsman, det spelar egentligen ingen roll. Och det ska man kunna göra i dagsläget. Men sen måste man också, även där, man måste vara medveten om att det är otroligt mycket, vad ska man säga, dels träningstimmar och en ökad risk att få ledbesvär när man tränar så otroligt mycket som de gör. Och just cyklister, de tränar ju mest i hela världen nästan. De är ju i antalet minuter, de är ute i timmar varje dag att träna. Det är ju ganska vanligt också att vi gör allt vi kan för att en person ska till exempel spela fotboll. Och sen blir de skadade, de kanske får en ledblödning, man rehabiliterar den. Det tar en stund att komma tillbaka. Så oftast kan ju personen själv känna att nej, men det kanske inte är värt det här. Det
blir lite självreglerande.
Ja, men det blir ju oftast det.
Man känner att kroppen inte orkar mer och man kanske inte orkar komma igen hela tiden heller.
Och då gäller det ju också då att göra lite som Alex föräldrar gjorde när han var liten. Att erbjuda någonting annat som de tycker är lika roligt men kanske då med lite mindre risker. Och just det sättet som Alex föräldrar ju använde, det tycker jag var helt fantastiskt. Att ja, men vi kanske inte kan göra det just nu, men under tiden så gör vi det här. Och så tog fokus från den där aktiviteten som man så gärna ville göra.
Avledningsmanöver, det är bra grejer.
Det är det.
Men du, hur viktigt är det med sport för en person som har blödarsjuka?
Jag tror och tycker att det är exakt lika viktigt som vem som helst. Med hemofili eller inte. Det är ju en fantastisk känsla att vara med i ett sammanhang, i en kontext, vara med i ett lag, vara med i motgångar, uppgångar. Så det är en otrolig vinst att hålla på med någon idrott. Och även om man håller på med en individuell idrott så är man ju oftast med i ett sammanhang ändå. Sen om man då tittar på de fysiologiska aspekten så är ju det lika viktigt också. Är man aktiv när man är ung tar man oftast med sig det in i vuxenlivet också. Att man fortsätter att vara aktiv. Så det är ju otroligt viktigt.
Jag tänker på det Alex berättade om läkaren som ifrågasatt att han höll på med den här sporten när han hade hemofili. Och hon fick svaret då att ja, men vad hade hänt, hur mycket hade det inte kostat om Alex vägde 10 kilo mer och var inte lika hälsosam, inte jobbade med att vara hälsosam i princip och hade också krävt mer faktorkoncentrat varannan dag och så vidare.
Ja, och det där är ju tyvärr sådana kommentarer man får höra på kongresser fortfarande, att mycket styrs av kostnad, vilket jag tycker är helt bedrövligt. Det är klart att vi har ett kostnadstänk, men vi tänker ju alltid först att det ska vara det bästa för patienten. Jag tror att det blir billigare att investera i en person när de är ung, att de får göra saker, de får ett sammanhang, skulle vi inte investera nu, då är man ju tillbaka som det var för 20, 30, 40 år sedan. Att man från 30-årsåldern så är man ganska märkt av sin hemofili. Att man har ledskador som gör att man har svårt att jobba till exempel.
Till sist, har du några uppmuntrande ord att skicka med de föräldrar med blödarsjuka barn som lyssnar på det här?
Var inte rädd för att testa saker. Utmana kanske er själva, utmana barnet. Och det viktiga är ju också att man ska vara lustfyllt, det ska vara roligt. Men man kanske ska ha i bakhuvudet att man ska vara förberedd.
Det är bra.
Det är jättebra. Mm.
Tack Magnus för att du var med i Blödigt Värre.
Tack snälla.
Du var med igen, du var ju faktiskt med i avsnitt 12 också. Där du berättade om din forskning i samband med att du blev tilldelad Arosenius-stipendiet.
Precis.
2017 var det va?
2017 stämmer.
Ja, ni får gärna gå in på blödigtvärre.se och lyssna på avsnitt 12 där man kan höra mer om dig då. Tack till er som lyssnat och tack till CSL Behring som gör den här podden möjlig. Hej då!
Hej då!